The following is a lecture by Rabbi David Kaplan. Rabbi Kaplan is originally from Chicago. He attended Northeastern University and received his rabbinical ordination in Jerusalem. He has lectured widely in Israel and America and is currently a senior lecturer at the main campus in Jerusalem.
The last one we did was the midst of returning back the lost items. Remember, we were talking about that. We got a little bit onto the story of theft. Just one point when it comes to stealing, that the Gemara says there was a man. Have you ever heard of Choni Hamagol, the man who slept for 70 years? According to the Talmud, there's a story about a man who slept for 70 years, which is exactly where they get the Rip Van Winkleberg, right? This is where they get all these stories. I remember a lot of stuff taken straight from our literature. But this guy, Choni Hamagol, there's a legend about a man. He had a grandson. His grandson's name was Abba Chilkia. And this Abba Chilkia was also one of the sages. So the Gemara says that the sages came to Abba Chilkia. It actually ties into this week's Parsha. Very interesting. The sages came to Abba Chilkia because they needed rain. And they were looking for this man, Abba Chilkia. And there was a drought, and they needed somebody to pray for rain. That's one of the things that Jews do when there's a drought. Jews daven, right? And so they were looking at this man, Abba Chilkia. Now, Abba Chilkia was not home. And they found him. He was out in the fields, right? So the Gemara mentions they came up to him, and they said hello, and he didn't answer. And then the Gemara goes through a whole series of a very strange behavior that he engaged in, right? And finally, at the end of the day, he invited them into the house, and they asked him, "Can you please explain your behavior?" And the first thing they wanted to know is, why when we said hello to you, he was out in the field hoeing. Right? And they said, we said hello to you and you didn't answer. One of the commentaries says, he did answer, he just didn't look at them. Right? And they asked him, why didn't you answer? When we said hello, why didn't you answer? So the Gemara says that he responded to them, because at the time, I was hired to do a certain job. Right? I was being paid for my hoeing. And for me to take any time off of that would be tantamount to theft. To me to stop hoeing and speak to you, I'm being paid for 60 minutes an hour, right? For me to stop what I'm doing. Now, obviously, he's being very extreme, right? But he's trying to teach a lesson, right? And the lesson is that when you are hired for something, that's also in the category of theft, what we were speaking about last time, that when a person is hired to do a job, we often take certain liberties when we do our jobs, right? They take certain liberties, well, the boss won't mind. Right, if I take a half-hour break right now, the boss won't mind. Right? We take these liberties, and in reality, we have no right to. Right? So that is also in the category of gezeila. Okay? Now, that's 130. 131, completely different mitzvah. This is the mitzvah of completely unrelated, completely and utterly unrelated. This is the mitzvah of removing a pan full of ashes from the top of the altar. Right, it's called the Haromas Hadeshen. Haromas Hadeshen means removing the ashes from the altar. This is the way the service in the temple started in the morning. Now, you know that there's an altar in the Beis Hamikdash. Right? There's a Mizbeach. And this Mizbeach, they burnt the sacrifices on the Mizbeach all day and all night. They were burning things on the Mizbeach. And eventually what happened was you got an accumulation of ashes. There was this accumulation of ashes top of the altar. Do you remember we spoke about what that accumulation of ashes was in a heap? Do you remember what that heap is called, Ilan? Tapuach. Very good. That heap is called the tapuach, the apple. Because an apple looks like you got a big apple on it. But it's called the tapuach, right? Which is why, what's at the source of what tradition? Dipping the apple in honey on Rosh Hashanah. Right? Dipping the tapuach in honey, because it means the fate of Yitzchak, the fate of Isaac, had he been slaughtered by Abram, he would have also been burnt and turned into a tapuach. It would turn into a heap of ashes. Therefore, we dip the apple into the honey on Rosh Hashanah to symbolize the fact that although Yitzchak was going to be sacrificed, eventually his fate was sweet. So that's the idea of the tefuach. Now, the Kohen would go up to the base of Mikdash, the top of the altar. He would dig out. He would take a pan. He would climb the ramp. He would take a pan. He would scoop out a pile of ashes, and then he would take it down and place it on the floor at the foot of the Mizbech, at the foot of the altar, And supernaturally, these ashes were absorbed into the floor of the Beis HaMikdash. Right? That shouldn't come as any surprise, because we know it says, Pirkei Avos says openly, there were 10 miracles that took place on a regular basis in the altar and the Beis HaMikdash. There were all sorts of supernatural occurrences there. Do you know that the Ark, you know how wide the Ark was? The Ark was 2.5 amas long by 1.5 amas wide. Approximately, let's say, 4 feet by 2 feet. Right? 4 feet long by 2 feet wide. Now, the Ark was in the Holy of Holies. Right? The Holy of Holies was 20 amos long. When they put the Ark down in the middle of the Holy of Holies, if you would have measured from either side of the Ark to the wall, they put this Ark down. Now, it's about 2 feet wide. If you measure from either side of it to the wall, you would come up with 20 amos. 10 amos here and 10 amos here. Yet if you measure from wall to wall, you also get 20 amos, which means what? The Ark didn't take up any space. Right? Something completely and utterly beyond our comprehension. Right? How could a physical object not take up any space in an enclosed area? Right? It's something it's hard for us to even comprehend, such thing, because beyond our entire ambit of comprehension is that we're able to, we can only comprehend those things which we can experience. We can't even begin thinking about it. You know, they talk about seeing the sounds at Har Sinai, right? They saw the sounds. God spoke and they saw the voice. It's a contradiction in terms for us. It's a contradiction in terms. We don't begin thinking in those terms, right?
After a while,
the Ark was hidden, right? But while it was in the Beis HaMikdash, it did not take up any space in the Holy of Holies. Okay. Now, whatever we think, the Ark was they carried it. No, they carried it. It was actually a physical object, but there was a super, what we call a supernatural aura surrounding it. Right, in the entire Beis HaMikdash, they were full of miracles. So one of the miracles, they took the ashes, put it on the floor, and it was absorbed into the floor. Now, what does that symbolize? Right. What is the idea over here? Why would they take the ashes off the altar? Why does that start the day? So there are various ideas that the commentaries come up with. First of all, the Talmud says that the altar, it was the mizbeach, the altar which provides sustenance to the world. That means in the merit of the sacrificial service, the world is sustained. What's the greatest worry man has? Right? What is the constant worry of mankind? Once in a while, you have people get sick, or people are unhealthy, or people have accidents. But what is the constant pressing worry of all mankind?
Mortality.
Food. Mortality isn't even a worry. Mortality we've given up on long ago. Mortality, we've come to grips with the facts. Right? Nothing's gonna save us. Right? At a certain point, we go. That's the way it is. We hope to make it to 120. Right, that's what we talk about in our tradition, to make it to 120. Right, but then again, we never stop and think that at about 95 we'll probably wish out. We'll probably wind our way out. Right, well, what do I want to live to 120 for? I haven't got teeth. I'm 95. I've got no teeth. Right, I can barely see. Right, and somehow life isn't, skiing isn't what it used to be. Right, or whatever it is. I'm ready at 95 to retire. Right, so we talk about living to 120 in the best of it. Well, what is it that man is constantly pursued by? What is this is part of the curse. This is part of the original curse to Adam, and this is the existence of mankind. And that is what you're telling. You said bread, food, a livelihood. Right? A livelihood is the pressing issue of mankind. Right? That's when Hashem said to Adam, you'll eat bread by the sweat of your brow. That means there are very few people in the world, right? You could count them, right? That are either struck it rich in computers, or they became professional basketball players, or they never have to work. Right? People are fabulously wealthy. All the rest of us have to work. We have to work, and we have to worry about making a livelihood and marrying off our children. Right? And putting them through. Some people worry about putting them through college. Right? Some people are blessed. They'll never put their kids through college. Right? They haven't got to worry about that. Right? Either way, that is the worry of mankind. Right? So there are so many things. You find all these prayers that we daven to Hashem constantly for Parnassah. One of the blessings that Shmoneh Esrei is for Parnassah. We're constantly focused on Parnassah. Constantly focused on, give me a livelihood. Without basic sustenance, we cannot live. The Beis HaMikdash, we find there were several things that were the source of the influence, right? We talked about the showbread, how the blessing came down from God. rested on the showbread, and it was that influence of that blessing that then goes off to the 12 tribes corresponding to the 12 showbreads, and that's what provides the blessing of Parnassah for the Jewish people. Where's the merit? What's the merit that the Jewish people have to earn their Parnassah? So the Talmud says, the Gemara says, the Mizbeach, the altar, one of the things the altar did for us is that the altar was a source of atonement, right? You brought sacrifices in order to gain an atonement. The altar was also a source of the energy necessary to provide us with a livelihood. That means in the merit of the temple sacrifices, we are provided with our basic sustenance. What's the connection? What's the altar got to do with our getting our basic sustenance? So what was sacrificed on the altar? The animals are sacrificed on the altar. What do the animals feed off? The animals feed off of basic, the earth and with the produce of the earth. That means we're taking the produce of the earth, whatever the produce of the earth is used for in sustaining these animals, and then we're taking these animals. Remember, Scott, you were asking me about is it a big sacrifice? At the time of the base of Midrash, a guy would bring a sacrifice. A massive sacrifice. Right? Nowadays, I gave Scott, we're talking about that, right? He gave an example. If nowadays, if every time you did an Avera, you had to bring a car to the base of Migdash, right? They'd sacrifice your automobile. Imagine they have this massive crane at the base of Migdash with a big ball, right? And you come to the base of Migdash, in the old days you took a sacrifice, you took an animal, you put your hands on the animal's head, right? You said your confession and then they would chef it. Imagine you bring your car, you put your hands on the hood of the car, right? You say, yes, I flicked the light switch on Shabbos. Right, and this massive ball trashes your car. Imagine that would happen every time. That would be quite a merit for us. Look what we're. That's why it's called a sacrifice. That's why it's called a sacrifice. Sacrifice means you feel it. If it's just a just a little, you bring a sheep, right? And you happen to have a couple hundred thousand of them. That's not much of a sacrifice. Right? But if it's something that's near and dear, then that's already a sacrifice. So in the time of the Beis Hamikdash, the merit of the Jewish people, their produce is being used to provide for animals. Animals are then taken and sacrificed on the altar. That altar is a merit for the Jewish people that you're willing to sacrifice. Therefore, in the merit of the altar, God brings us, the merit of the altar is that God is going to repay us with parnassa. So he takes the ashes off of these sacrifices and he places them on the ground, symbolizing that we want this divine influence that's going to provide us with our parnassa to come from up there and rest on the earth. That's the putting of the ashes on the ground, that the divine earth rests on the earth. Okay? Well, any questions on that? Yes, that's what the commentaries point out. The word sacrifice, just remember that sacrifice is always synonymous with difficulty. When people talk about getting married and sacrificing in marriage, right? When you're not married, you always picture it as, yeah, of course, you know, it's not difficult. You know, I'll be so in love, you know, that you know, yeah, but well, if it's not difficult for you, that's not a sacrifice, right? Then how much is it worth? The value is when it becomes a sacrifice, when it feels, when it hurts. And you have to do it even though you don't want to do it. That's when it has the most value. And it's always a sacrifice. That's the idea of tzedakah also, to a certain extent. Tzedakah is meant to sting a little bit, right? When you give tzedakah, if it feels too good, it's not having the desired effect. Right? Why is there such a merit for tzedakah? Tremendous merit. Tzedakah can save from death. You know, the Gemara, there's a verse that says, tzedakah tatzel mimavis. It's a verse. Charity saves from death. Why should charity save from death? Why should charity, what's the mita kenegan mita? Because there's a little bit of us dying every time we give charity. Right? That means when you give the charity, that's supposed to sting. That's why you can't give your time. Do you know that? Time is a wonderful thing. You know, the Quarantine tradition, you give a 10% of your money to charity. You know that? 10%? If you want, you give up to 20%. Right? You cannot give more than 20%, one-fifth. You cannot give more than that because you're worried that you become poor too. Right? You can't give too much. On the other hand, you have to give a certain minimal amount. That's 10%. 10% of the money you have to give to charity. Right?
If a person wants
to give 10%, let's say I've earned $10,000 this year, right? And $10,000 after taxes, take away all the taxes, right? My net profits were $10,000 this year, I'd have to give $1,000 to charity, right? Let's say I don't, instead of giving $1,000 to charity, I'll give $500 to charity, and then I'll do $500 worth of community service. Right? Wouldn't that be nice? I'll go volunteer at an old age home where they would have had to pay somebody, and I'll work off $500 worth of debt at the old age home. Do you know that's not sufficient according to halacha? According to halacha, you cannot work off. If you have no choice, then it's one thing. But if you have a choice, you're not allowed to. Why not?
Because your time is valuable.
Your time is valuable. So why can't I use that instead of giving the money? Because there's something inherently precious in you taking a $10 bill out of your pocket and parting with it. That does more to you than when you do work which is of that value. Because seeing the money, when you invite somebody into your house, you invite a friend over, right? The same guy that you invite into your house, you give him a good meal, you let him use the shower, you let him use the facilities, he's using electricity, taking out, this guy's costing you money if he stays at your house over the weekend, right? What if instead you put out a big meal on the table, instead of the meal, says, you know what, I'd rather have $5, right? Would you give it, would you ever in your right, in your mind, in your wildest dreams, give your friend $5 just outright, right? The same person who's eaten a meal by you, who you've spent $5 or $10 on him, says he needs to make a long distance call, long distance telephone call. Then it's understood he's going to pay for that. Why is that understood? And it's a universal. It's right. That you're going to pay. Why? Because that's cold cash.
It's funny
right?
How it works. It's true.
It's true. Because that's cash. That's money. Right? The money, if the same guy is leaving your house and he needs bus fare, and you give him $2, that you're expecting back. The chicken that you gave him, or the meat that you gave him, the meal you gave him, that you never expect back. The money you expect back. Because there's something inherently precious about the money, as opposed to, it's much easier to give away food than it is to give away the money. Because you don't see the money anymore. So charity is the same thing. The sacrifice is where you see yourself giving away the cash. Right? That's the sacrifice. That's like even writing a check, which is perfectly okay. Right? It doesn't. I don't think it has the same sting. Right, writing a check using a credit card. That's what one of the things that credit card companies capitalize on. It doesn't have the same sting. And I've even heard people say that spending shekels in Israel is not the same as spending dollars in America. I know for me it is, you know, much easier to spend shekels than dollars. Dollars are real money. And you feel you're doing something significant with a dollar. With a shekel, yeah, another 30 shekels there, 40 shekels, big deal. Right?
It's
monopoly money
anyway.
Exactly, exactly. I have chips in Vegas because it's easier to throw down a $20, $500 chip than to throw out $500 cash on the table. Okay, so that's the idea of the sacrifices. Number 132 is the command that there must be a constant fire burning on the altar. Now, in the altar in the Beis Hamikdash, you know there were two altars. There's the outside altar, the inside altar. The outside altar must have a constant fire burning on it. This involved three. How do you pronounce the word P-Y-R-E?
Pyres.
There were pyre?
Yeah.
Three pyres. I don't know if some of you, it's pier or pyre, right? There are three pyres on the altar, and these pyres had to have fire burning on them on a constant basis. The according to our tradition, the fire on the altar came down from heaven. That's what started the original fire. But even so, we have an obligation to keep on adding to that fire. So one of the things that they did in the Beis Hamikdash, they had to put logs on the altar constantly. Remember I told you, where did the logs come from? They had a woodshed attached to the altar, and they had to make sure that the logs did not have any worms in them, because they may have gotten moldy or moist or whatever. Who was it who made sure that there were no worms in the wood? The Kohanim that were unfit for the service. The Kohanim that were unfit for the service in the Beis Hamikdash, they were the ones that made sure that there was nothing nothing unsavory about the log. Now, so the Kohanim were in that worked in the woodshed. Their job was to take the wood out of the Beis Hamikdash. Now, to take the worms out of the wood. Now, the command that the fire has to burn constantly is specifically that you must keep feeding the logs on the fire so that the fire has something to burn. What do you think the symbolism is here?
Hashem is a consuming fire.
Okay, absolutely correct. Hashem is a consuming fire.
Must keep serving.
What else?
Well, the Torah must be constant. Must never be...
What must be?
Torah.
Where do you get Torah? You're absolutely correct. It's a bullseye. That means the flame. Flame is essentially a spiritual energy. Right? The flame burning on the altar is symbolic of Torah. Right? We always talk about Torah as a flame. You know that the Gemara says that Rabbi Yonasan ben Uziel, the famous sage Hillel, had 80 disciples. That's what the Gemara says. He had 80 disciples. His greatest disciple, the Gemara says, the least of his disciples, right? The smallest of all his 80 disciples was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was the leading sage at the end of the Second Temple era. A man of incredible Torah knowledge. The Talmud describes Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. The greatest sage of Hillel was Rabbi Yonasan ben Uziel. Rabbi Yonasan ben Uziel, the Gemara says, when he sat and studied Torah, their birds flying overhead would burn up in his flame when he studied Torah. Right? There was such a spiritual energy coming from him that it would burn up. I don't think that he went hunting. You know, I don't think he said, okay, gee, I need some lunch today. They open up his Baba Kama, and all of a sudden, doing, doing, they started falling around him on the table, right? It means, I think the Gemara is describing more the potential than the actual fact that the Gemara is more interested in telling us the type of holiness, the type of levels that he reached, more than the fact that he was able to knock birds out of the sky. The commentators actually ask a very cute question. If this was the disciple, imagine the Rebbe. Right? Imagine what was Hillel like? If Rabbi Yonasan ben Uziel could burn up birds, right? So what was the Rebbe like? So one of the commentaries says, well, Yonasan ben Uziel could only burn them up within a range of 4 amos. Right? When Hillel learned, he had long-range bombers, right? He could reach them at a distance. This is what one of the commentaries says. I saw a much better answer. One of the other commentaries says, Rabbi Yonasan ben Uziel burned up the birds. Hillel, the Rebbe, was able to control his fire. Right? He didn't burn up the birds. Right? That was part of his greatness, was being able to control his fire. But Torah is, there's always an analogy to Torah and fire. So you're absolutely correct. The idea over here is that the flame of Torah must never be allowed to burn out. Who's that responsibility on?
Jewish people.
The Jewish people must do what? What is wood? And good wood going into fire is symbolic of what?
Well, studying the Torah, keeping the mitzvahs.
What is that? What are they doing to the fire? We even use this. It's such as you feed the fire, right? What does that mean? You're supposed to take care of Torah scholars. Torah scholars are, you have an obligation to support Torah and to support Torah scholars. It's the idea of feeding the fire. And the symbolism is so parallel, because who in fact sustains the Torah scholars? Who provides Parnassa? It's a fascinating idea. Who provides Parnassa? God provides Parnassa, right? Yet, that means you have a poor person. If you come up to the poor person, you give the poor person money. Are you supporting the poor person?
You're a conduit.
Let's say you go up and you find a poor person on the street. You give a poor person money. Are you supporting the poor person?
Yes.
Yes, you are. Assuming you give him money, right? What if you wouldn't give him the money? So we believe, or in our tradition, we believe if you wouldn't do it, somebody else would. Right? One way or another, it's predetermined what he's going to get. Right? If you don't grab the opportunity, somebody else. So who, in fact, is really supporting him?
God.
God is supporting him. You just happen to be the agent of God to give him the money. When they were burning the fire on the altar in the Beis Hamikdash, right? That fire was a divine fire. Are they actually feeding the fire? They're not actually feeding the fire. The fire didn't need any wood to burn. The fire, the original fire on the altar, was a divine fire that came down from heaven. And that flame remained burning on the altar. Does God's flame need any type of wood to keep it burning? Right? God had a flame at the burning bush. Right? The burning bush. The bush was burning, yet it wasn't being consumed. Right? So obviously the fire was not burning anything. It wasn't consuming anything.
Well, yeah, because it's burning the wood.
It was over here, but would it be extinguished if the wood wouldn't be burning? It's a divine fire.
It would be, because God would show them that they're not taken care of.
Correct. But in fact, does God require the wood? He does not. The same way, the people who support Torah scholars, those scholars are going to get the support one way or another. Right, but the people have, you have an obligation to do your part in the mitzvah and not just say, well, God will take care of him if I don't, so leave it to God. You have an obligation to grab. Remember when Mordechai and Esther and on the Purim story, the Jewish people are desperate. The Jewish people are on the verge of physical annihilation. Right? There's a decree that the Jews are going to be annihilated. Mordechai comes to Esther and he wants her to go and convince Ahasuerus to plead. He wants her to plead with Ahasuerus to try to rescind the decree. Right? If you were going to try to convince somebody to plead for your life, what would you do? Your life is in jeopardy. There's somebody who could become an intermediary. What would you do when you went to beg with to plead with this immediate intermediary? What would you do? You would throw yourself down and grovel at their feet and promise them everything in the world. Right? Mordechai uses a very unique way of begging Esther to do the job. What does Mordechai say to her? Esther, we need you to beg with Ahasuerus. And if you don't, well, that's okay, because we're going to be delivered by someone. Some other way we'll get our deliverance, right? You and your entire family are going to go lost, right? You'll be lost from Jewish history. You'll have no portion in anything, and we're going to be saved some other way. Not a very convincing way to convince. They ask somebody that. Look, do me a favor. Can you lend me some money? And if you don't, that's okay, because if you don't, somebody else will. Right? We don't do that, though, because we're worried somebody may call our bluff. Right? We haven't got the faith Mordechai has. But ultimately, where's it coming from? Ultimately, it's coming from God. That's the message of the altar. Right? You got to feed it, but just remember that even though you're feeding it, the divine fire is actually the fire that's burning. And the divine fire doesn't need any wood at all. Yeah?
So, this might be a little bit off subject. But
go ahead.
Do they feed the fire also on Shabbos? Like, feed the wood on the fire? Because I know that that's a rabbinic law.
Did they feed the fire in the base of Mikdash? I'm not absolutely, I have to look it up, but I'm under the impression that they did. Because it was an Esh Tamid, it was constantly being burnt, and I'm under the impression they did, but I'm not absolutely positive. I have to double check. Yeah?
I heard that they have a full right to put the Beit HaMikdash because on Shabbos only God said that you are not allowed to do work in your hands, not in mine.
Well, in the base of Mikdash, the Torah law is still applied. Rabbinic laws didn't apply in the base of Mikdash. There are none of the rabbinic decrees applied in the base of Mikdash because the Kohanim were thought to be extreme. The whole point of rabbinic law was to create a fence to stop people from transgressing. And since the Kohanim were very careful in what they were doing, then there was no need for those rabbinic laws in the base of Mikdash. The question is whether putting those logs on the fire would be a rabbinic law, or you're actually increasing the fire. That's a Torah law. Just one second. I have to check. There's a Mishnah that discusses Yuma. Let me check. I'll try to get back to you tomorrow. I have to remember to look it up, right? But I'm not sure. Good question. They always say good questions. So I don't look bad, right? You know, it's one of those things that it's one of those. My favorite line of all is when you say something with all due respect, and with all due respect, because then you can say anything you want after that. You know, with all due respect, bring it on and blast away. I'll check. We know. Okay, next one. 133. Is the opposite. Remember we spoke about there are certain positive commands that have two sides attached to them, right? Negative and positive on the same mitzvah. Technical mitzvah, this is the prohibition to put out the flame on the altar, right? The first one is that you must keep the flame burning. The flip side is prohibited to put out the flame, which means that just from a technical point of view, you're not allowed to knock any of the coals off of the altar. That's the prohibition. Number 134 is also a technical mitzvah. That means that after the mincha sacrifice, the mincha offering, which is a meal offering, right? When a poor man brought an offering to the base of Mikdash, or when they brought a meal offering, it's the flour mixed with the oil. So what they would do is, on a regular sacrifice, if they brought an animal, what did they do? They would shech the animal, and depending on what sacrifice it was, some of it would be burnt on the altar, and the rest of it would generally be consumed either by the Kohanim or by the owner of the sacrifice. By a meal offering, there's something called a kometz. A kometz is, they would bring in this pan with the flour and the oil, and the Kohen would take his fingers like this. He would take these three fingers and scoop out whatever he could hold in those three fingers, and then he would use this finger over here and the thumb over here to smooth out the top and the bottom, and whatever was contained in here would be burnt on the altar. That's the part of the mincha that was a sacrifice, and the rest of this mincha was eaten by the Kohanim. Okay, that's 134. I'm sorry? What's that?
It sounds like something they came up with themselves when the meal offering started to look real good.
No, why? They got, oh, you mean who the Kohanim? Yeah, give away a little bit and keep on. All these are straight commands in the Torah. There are verses in the Torah that talk about the komets.
With
the fingers, yeah. Straight commands in the Torah. Yeah.
You know, in this 613, there's plenty of those things before that we cannot do. Let's say we Israelis, right? How are we supposed to, let's say, when we talk about the 613, how are we supposed to
Who said that you're making a basic assumption? The basic assumption is there's 613 mitzvot that every Jew fulfills. Right? That's an assumption. That's not correct. There's 613 mitzvot. Of those 613 mitzvot, you are responsible for the ones that you are able to fulfill. Right? And nobody is able to fulfill all 630 mitzvot. Right? That's the basic idea. Remember, I told you that according to the Kabbalists, everybody comes back, everybody is incarnated at all three. But in a basic lifetime, you're absolutely right. You cannot fulfill. Not only that, if you're a Kohen, if you're living outside the land of Israel, there are also mitzvot you can't fulfill. Right, Moshe Rabbeinu was dying to get into the land of Israel. Right, one of the reasons is that the Vilna Gaon wanted to get into the land. There are certain mitzvahs that don't apply outside of Israel. Right, so, yeah.
So, what is the actual sacrifice? Is it the taking the three fingers?
The taking the three fingers. That's the actual sacrifice. That's the part of it that's burned on the altar, and then the rest of it is eaten by the Kohanim.
And that's the whole thing is
mitzvah. Scott, this is the proof. The proof that they didn't make it up themselves, right? Because mitzvah 135 is the restriction on how they're allowed to eat it, right? They are not allowed to put a leavening agent into it and bake it and let it rise up nice and fat, right? They have to keep it flat or whatever was burned. They're not allowed to put in. The mitzvah is to not bake their portion into chametz. That the remnants of the mincha should not be made into chametz. That means not be leavened and allowed to rise. Now,
what was it? You said it was Oil and flour.
Basically, oil and flour that mixed together, and they were different pans. There were sometimes there were deeper pans, and there were a deep pan, and there were.
Please turn the tape to the other side.